So let's continue one more class today, right? I think so. So the third of Eisfeldt's arguments is actually summarizing what he is calling the peculiarities of linguistic usage and thought. And that actually has many sub-points. Firstly, he says, there is a difference in the historical perspective, theme, and subject matter. In that chapters 1 through 39 deal with the historical threat from Assyria, that's the historical focus. Whereas chapters 40 through 66 deal with the return from exile. So the focus, the perspective, the theme is two different time periods. Following from that, there are differences in theological ideas, the theological focus. The first half of the book is prophecies of destruction, judgment. The second half of the book is prophecies of hope, restoration, salvation, very, very different theological themes. And then thirdly, and we're not going to get into this in detail right now, differences in language and style. And he'll give, and supporters of this will give, lists of words that are only found in the first section of the book, or phrases only found in the first section of the book, or only found in the second half of the book. And they'll say it shows a different vocabulary. It shows that it's a different author with a different, well, different vocabulary, different style of writing. Now, I'm going to get into that in more detail in a minute when we kind of critique it. But for now, I want to just jump over that and say, okay, there's his argument. There's the basic heart of his argument. But I want to deal with a very obvious question. His theory is that three separate prophets wrote three separate books. So that brings up the very obvious question we have to answer. How did three books become one book? Because in our Bible, it's just the book of Isaiah. It's not three books, it's one book. And 100% of the early evidence shows one book. The New Testament quotes the book of Isaiah, first part, second part, all sorts of parts. The New Testament quotes the book of Isaiah and says, this is Isaiah, all of it. The Jewish rabbis, the Mishnah, the Talmud, treat Isaiah as one book. The Dead Sea Scrolls has several copies of Isaiah, one book. So at least as early as the Dead Sea Scrolls, the New Testament, there was absolutely no thought or awareness that this was three books. They treated it all as one book. So if the division of Isaiah is true, then we have to answer the question, how did three books become one book at such an early stage, so thoroughly that the division was forgotten? Because there is zero manuscript or real evidence to support that. All the evidence is that this is one book, going back to the earliest times. So how does three books become one? Eisfeldt knows he has to answer that question. It's a legitimate question. And so he gets into that. And he says, well, there are several options. Here's the first option. It's very possible that a great prophet like Isaiah had followers. He had disciples who really respected the great prophet and so followed in his footsteps. We see an example of this in 1 Kings chapter 6, at the time of Elisha. where there is a company of little prophets, junior prophets, disciple prophets, following Elisha. Elisha had his school, we could call it. He had a school of prophets surrounding him. And so they theorize, here's one possibility. Maybe the great Isaiah, who was this respected prince of prophets, also had his followers, his disciples, who continued his ideas, continued his thoughts and his thinking. And so the theory is that this Isaiah school continued then for centuries, as they continued to follow the example of the great historical Isaiah, following his writings. And so one option, Eisfeld says, is that these disciples or admirers of Isaiah intentionally added their words to his book. They had Isaiah, and they just added on, intentionally enlarging his book over several hundred years. Now, does that sound very logical to you? Does it sound logical that an admirer of Isaiah, someone who really respects Isaiah, would think, I am going to add my words into his book? I'm going to pretend that my words are his words. I respect him so much. Doesn't really make sense. Because if you respect that person so much, you would not pretend that your words are his. It's dishonest. It's the opposite of plagiarism, right? Plagiarism is where you pretend his words are your words. This is the opposite. It's pretending your words are his words. It's dishonest. And there's a problem, because it really is the second half of Isaiah that is the part that has, that going back to ancient times, the Jewish rabbis said, this is the prince, here we see the prince of prophets. It's the second half of Isaiah that has some of the most beautiful theological, profound theological, spiritual prophecies. And so to say that those people were also dishonest, pretending their words are actually Isaiah's words, those things don't really go together. It doesn't really fit. It doesn't make sense. And Eisfeld pretty much seems to agree. He says, yes, it is technically possible that they were intentionally adding to the book of Isaiah, but Eisfeld says that's doubtful. That's not a realistic possibility. So, okay, if that's out, then what other options are there? How did these three books become one book? Eisfeld says, well, there's another option. If it's not intentional, then maybe it was an accident. And so the theory is given that they had Isaiah, and then they also had these two anonymous prophecies by anonymous prophets, and don't know who wrote them, but they had these anonymous prophecies. And it just so happened that the Isaiah scroll had some space left over. There were blank space at the end. And so they said, well, we have these anonymous prophecies. We need to write them down somewhere. We'll write them down here. We've got this blank space. So they leave a space, a divider, so that they make it clear this is now a different prophecy. They leave a space and they write out the anonymous prophecy one, and then leave a space and write out the anonymous prophecy two. But they're just putting it all on the same scroll just to make use of the space. But the next generation forget that these are two different or three different prophecies. They're all on the same scroll and there's a space, but well, space isn't important. They make a copy and they just copy it all out on one scroll. And so it's kind of an accident that these anonymous prophecies were put together with Isaiah. And then a later generation just assumed that, well, it's all one book, it's all Isaiah. Okay, Eisfeld says that is also a possibility. Logically, maybe that could happen. Eisfeld suggests that maybe it was just an accident. Now, is that a good explanation? No. And Eisfeld agrees. No, that's okay, maybe theoretically, but no. They're very doubtful. And I would actually go even further and say it's not doubtful, it's just plain wrong. Because it's thinking like a book. If you have a notebook, vihik, okay, you get a blank notebook and you write something out, but then you've got 10 pages at the end. What are you going to do with those 10 pages? You can't just take them out, because if you take those pages out, the book will fall apart. The binding of the book doesn't allow you to just take pages out of a book. And so, well, I've used them for something, I'll write something else here. But a scroll is totally different. Scroll is a totally different technology. A scroll, you roll it out, you start writing, you come to the end. Ah, well, the scroll continues another 2 meters. No problem. Cut. And add the stick, tie the stick on the end, and there you go. There's your scroll. You can cut a scroll at any point and just create a new scroll. It's not like a book. With a book, that kind of could make sense. If you think of a notebook where you're writing things in by hand, that could make sense. But with a scroll, it doesn't make any sense. You just cut the scroll and create a new scroll. So, no. This is totally nonsense. And as I said, Eisfeld agrees, no, that can't be the explanation. There has to be something else. And so he comes to his third option. And he says, it is more probable that 2nd and 3rd Isaiah were united with 1st Isaiah, quote, just because similarities of style and content suggest they were derived from the same author. And the similarity between the two extends into linguistic usage. Page 346 of his book. See, I'm giving references just to show. Give references, just not in UPA format. Okay. Did you pay attention to that? He said, how did three books become one book? Well, the more probable explanation is that they were united because the similarity of style and content suggests they were from the same author. Similarity extends into linguistic usage. There's his answer. This is the more probable. How did three books become one book? Because they were so similar in style, content, linguistic usage, so similar that the Hebrew readers thought it's the same author. It sounds like the same author. You're smiling. Why are you smiling?
Ilmselt nad on targemad, sest nemad nägid, et meil on erinevused. Nad ei ole sama autor, sellepärast, et on keelekasutus ja võtte
erinevused. It's very interesting that on page 304, Eisfeld had used the differences or the peculiarities in linguistic usage and thought as one of his main arguments to divide the book, that they can't be from the same author. because of the differences in linguistic usage and thought. And 40 pages later, the similarity in style, content, linguistic usage is his explanation of how the three different books became one. So, Gadre, as you said, his only way of arguing, justifying this, is to say that he is much smarter than those old ancient Jewish rabbis. Okay, I'm glad you're so proud of your own intelligence. But do you see a problem here? He's using the same argument to divide the book and to unite the book. The same argument, the style, the linguistic usage, the content. He's using the similarities as an explanation for why they are united as one book, but the differences to argue that they can't be one book. Can you use the same argument both ways? If you're smart enough, you can try. Yeah. But what are you effectively demonstrating? How big are the differences? How big are the differences in linguistic usage and thought? Not very big. Because if the differences were very big, he could never use that as an explanation for how the three different books were united. If the differences were big, he could not possibly use it as the explanation for how three books became one. By using it as an explanation for how three books become one, he is admitting that the differences are very small. They're so small that the average person is not going to notice it. They're so small that not just average, but the intelligent Jewish rabbis, I'm not going to say that they were ignorant people. They were very intelligent. These Jewish rabbis were smart people. The point is, he's really canceling himself out. He's showing that the differences actually are not as great as he make you think. If you only read to page 304, and you could very easily come to the conclusion that Professor Dr. Otto Eisfeld, with all his great training, says very clearly that the differences are the reason we have to divide the book. But actually, the differences are not as great as he would like us to think. So, let's look at those differences. The peculiarities of linguistic usage and thought was his argument why these books should be divided. First category here was differences in the historical perspective, different theme, different subject matter. The argument is that chapters 1 through 39 deal with the situation in the 8th century, the threat from Assyria, the time of the historical prophet, whereas the last half of the book deals with the return from exile. That's the historical focus, the theme, which is 200 years later. That's his argument. And in general, it's not completely wrong. Generally speaking, he can make this claim. The problem is that the division is not nearly as clear as he would like you to think. He will say it's clear. First half deals with the threat from Assyria. Second half deals with the return from exile. But then you actually start reading the text. Actually read the book of Isaiah. And what do you find? You find that the 8th century threat from Assyria is also present at the end of the book, and the situation from the return of the exile is also present at the beginning of the book. They're actually interconnected. Give some examples here. Isaiah 13 and 14 are prophecies of the destruction of Babylon, which is something that will happen 200 years later. It's talking about the return from exile. The destruction of Babylon is what causes the return from exile. But this is in the first half of the book. Then there's chapter 39, which directly predicts the Babylonian exile, prophecy of the Babylonian exile, which of course is something that happens 200 years later over here. I don't have these in order, but chapter 21 is a very interesting chapter. It is a prophecy, again, of the destruction of Babylon, which will happen 200 years later over here. But it says Babylon will be destroyed by the Medes and Elam. If you want to see how the names are spelled, just open up Isaiah 21 and you'll find it there somewhere. Babylon will be destroyed by Media and Elam. Who destroys Babylon? 200 years later, Babylon will be destroyed by the Medes and their allies, the Persians. The Medes and the Persians are allies. They have a joint empire. The Medes and the Persians destroy Babylon 200 years later. But in Isaiah 21, it says Babylon will be destroyed by the Medes, Media, and Elam. Now, do you want to hear something interesting? At the time of the historical prophet Isaiah, the 8th century, the time of the historical prophet Isaiah, there was no country of Persia. There was no country called Persia. Do you want to guess what the country, what that territory was called at the time of the historical Isaiah? Guess. Because I've just been saying the name.
Elam,
exactly. Elam was the name for the same geographical region, basically, that would become Persia 200 years later. And so in Isaiah 21, it's a prophecy that Babylon will be destroyed by Media, the Medes, and Elam. It's using an 8th century name. If it was written 200 years later, it would have said Persia. But it was using the old name, the name from that time, which I think is very interesting. Overall, Babylon, which was the enemy at the time of the exile, is actually referred to more often in the first half of the book than in the second half of the book. So the part of the book that actually is supposed to talk about the threat from Assyria, and generally it does, overall it does, but it's also repeatedly talking about Babylon. It actually talks about Babylon more often than the second half of the book, which supposedly is dealing with the end of the Babylonian exile. The point is, when you read the text of Isaiah, you see repeated interconnection between these two historical time periods. Now, does Eisfeld know this? That these passages exist? Obviously. He has a doctoral degree, he is a professor in a German university theology faculty. He is very educated. He's read Isaiah. He knows they're there. But still he says, chapters 1 through 39 deals only with the threat from Assyria. The historical Isaiah wrote only about the threat from Assyria. How can he say that? Because every passage I just mentioned, he will identify as what? Something we've been talking about through this class. Later additions, exactly. All of these passages are later additions. The historical Isaiah did not talk about the destruction of Babylon. He only spoke about the threat from Assyria, according to Eisfeld. But the only way he can claim that is to identify all of these as later additions, cut them out, and just sort of glue them on at the end of the book. Well, they actually belong over here. That is called changing the evidence to fit your theory. And if you're changing the evidence to fit your theory, that is not a good thing. Well, let's go on. Okay, well, just say, overall, Eisfeld is generally right that, generally speaking, chapters 1 through 39 does primarily deal with the threat from Assyria. That is true. And I will also agree that chapters 40 through 66 are primarily talking about the return from exile. I agree with that. Overall, he's right. But there are many exceptions, and there are actually exceptions going in both directions. I only gave examples in one direction, but there are exceptions on both sides. The next point he brings up is differences in theological ideas. And again, he does have a point that the first half of the book primarily are prophecies of destruction. The theological theme is judgment on sin. Sin will be judged. And so they are prophecies of destruction because of judgment on the sin of Judah. Whereas when you start in chapter 40, I mean, it just changes immensely. You've read all these chapters of judgment, and it's sad and depressing and painful, and then all of a sudden, chapter 40, verse 1, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended." Suddenly, chapter 40 just explodes with comfort, with hope, restoration, salvation is arriving. Now, there is definitely a change in theological theme overall, speaking generally. Absolutely. You read the book, it's obvious. Is that change in theological ideas evidence of different authors? Can one prophet give prophecies of judgment and prophecies of hope, comfort, salvation? Absolutely. If this was a contradiction, if it was impossible logically to believe both, then it would be definite evidence of two different authors, because you don't expect someone to contradict themselves. But this is not a contradiction. I mentioned this, I think, yesterday. It is totally possible that you can preach a sermon on judgment and salvation together. And like I said yesterday, this is the way it should be. If you go to a church that only preaches judgment on sin, stop going to that church. That's a bad church. But if you go to a church that only talks about love and salvation and everything's, or not, well, salvation is a complicated theme. it involves everything. If you only if the church only talks about all is good and comfort and hope, and never talks about judgment on sin or repentance of sin, stop going to that church as well. I mean, both extremes are theologically wrong and dangerous and horrible in reality. Christian theology is both. In fact, it is both in sequence. They come in a chronological order. What comes first? Actually, that's, well, in the beginning, it was perfect. Garden of Eden, creation, blessing, perfect. But after sin arrived, the world in which we live, these two themes go together, and they go together in order. First comes judgment on sin. First comes repentance from sin, and then comes hope, salvation, restoration. These two themes have to go together. It's essential that they go together, and that they go together in this order. It's absolutely essential. I mean, look at Leviticus chapter 26 or Deuteronomy chapter 28. These are passages from the Mosaic law where the covenant, the terms of the covenant are spelled out. And, well, in this case, it's kind of the opposite order. If you obey, you will be blessed. If you disobey, you will be punished. But Deuteronomy 28 ends, after you are punished, there is hope. After judgment comes hope. This is an essential part of our theology, that these two themes go together. So there's absolutely no contradiction. There's absolutely no reason why a prophet can't talk about both, because they have to go together. So there's no reason that they have to come from different authors. But again, even dividing the book and saying chapters 1 through 39 is destruction and judgment on sin, 40 through 66 is salvation and hope. I mean, have you read Isaiah? Come on, you should know better than that. You do, you just aren't maybe remembering. Isaiah chapter 4, the branch of the Lord, a branch grows out that will cleanse the people. It's a picture of salvation, of restoration. That's a topic from over here, but it's already there in Isaiah 4. Isaiah 9, everybody knows that. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and he will have an eternal and just reign. I mean, Christmas is coming. Salvation is coming, is Isaiah 9. Isaiah 12 is a song of praise for God's salvation. Isaiah 14, verses 1 and 2, specifically talk about the return from exile. Chapter 26, praising God for his salvation. Chapter 35, joy after turning to God. All of these are hope, restoration, salvation. But they come in systematically throughout the book of the first half of Isaiah. So when chapter 40 comes, and from chapter 40 on, it is almost entirely positive. Hope and restoration, salvation, comfort. But that is built upon themes that have been hinted at from the very beginning. It's not a radical change. It is simply developing those themes that have been hinted at regularly. When I read Isaiah, I get the impression that Isaiah was the kind of man who was very optimistic. He was very positive. And God gave him prophecies of judgment on sin. But he didn't like it. I mean, who does? It's not nice. And so he gives a few prophecies of judgment, and then he just has to come out with hope. He can't only talk about judgment on sin, because he has to come out and give a hope of salvation. All the way through 1 through 39, it's just constantly trying to break out. And then finally you get to chapter 40, and he just lets it explode. Salvation, hope, comfort, restoration, all that positive message takes over. But according to Eisfeld, there is a clear difference in theological ideas. The historical prophet Isaiah prophesied destruction. How does he explain that? How does he explain all of these passages later editions, exactly. Again, he will say, well, these are all later editions. They were not written by the historical prophet. They were written after and then brought back into the first half, but they're not original. And so again, he will claim there is a clear, definite difference in theological ideas. Because anything that doesn't fit his theory, he cuts out and rearranges. Differences in literary style and vocabulary, language and style. As I said, he can give you a list of verses, or of words, of phrases that are only used in the first half, or only used in the second half. And he will argue that the language and style shows a different author. But remember, like I said, for one thing, Isaiah was active for possibly 60 years, at least 40 years, he was active as a prophet. Do you seriously think he only used one style of writing, one set of vocabulary? I mean, new words would have come in. As the time changed, the topics change, themes change, vocabulary changes as well. All of that has to be considered in this. And so you have to ask the question, if you see a unique, colorful phrase that's used in the second part of the book that's never used in the first part of the book, is that because it's a different author? Or is it because this man happens to be very creative and he developed a new expression? I mean, Isaiah, if anybody of the biblical authors was poetic, okay, David wrote Psalms, but Isaiah, it is poetry. It's very poetic, it's very creative. So unique phrases are not something that you can say, well, obviously he did not write that. He was a very talented writer. And actually, we can argue that the similarity in language and style, especially language, is far more obvious than the differences. For example, Isaiah, as I said, very talented. He has unique phrases such as referring to God as the Holy One of Israel. This is something that is almost unique to Isaiah. This phrase, calling God the Holy One of Israel, it's used 12 times in the first half of the book, 14 times in the second half of the book. In the rest of the Old Testament, it's only used 5 times. So it's not totally unique to Isaiah. But this is Isaiah's favorite. He is the one who really likes to call God the Holy One of Israel, equally in both halves of the book. The phrase, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken it. Very much. It's used in the first half. It's used in the second part and in the third part. It's a very unique expression. But it's used in each of the three parts of Isaiah. And the ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. first part, chapter 35, and chapter 51. The same verse is used, the same words are used. The lion shall eat straw like the ox. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. Again, very poetic, very picture. I mean, it's very, the imagery is very clear and strong and powerful. It's used in chapter 11 and chapter 65, the first part and the last part of the book, referring to a highway of our God running through the desert. Again, it's a very interesting image, a very unique image that's used in both the first part of the book and the second part of the book. And we could go on with this, with phrases like this, where it's so obvious the same words, the same ideas are being used. You can go into something much more detailed, which is not my speciality, so I will just quote a real Hebrew specialist, Gleason Archer, who uses an example, the use of amar. Amar is he said in Hebrew, but using amar, he said, of Yahweh, in the imperfect tense, not the perfect tense, is a peculiarity unique to Isaiah used in both halves of the book. Okay, this is something very, very technical grammar thing. The exact tense that is used, he said, used of Yahweh, in the imperfect, not the perfect tense. Very, very specific grammatical construction. But it's in both parts of the book. There are themes common to both sides of the book, such as the perversion of justice. Compare these passages and you'd see the same theme appears. The hypocrisy of the people. Again, the same themes reappear in both halves of the book. And we could go on. There are many more examples I could give. The point is, well, okay, not the point is. How would Eisfeld respond? How would he explain the incredible similarity in vocabulary, in phrases used in both halves of the book? Now, he could say, and probably will say, some of them are later additions, not original. But remember, he also brought up the idea that 2nd and 3rd Isaiah, whoever wrote them, were disciples of Isaiah. They were students of Isaiah. They were fans of Isaiah, who were intentionally copying his style of writing, his language, his themes. And so then we're left with the problem, okay, well, then where does that leave us? Because he used the division, the differences of linguistic usage and thought as the basis to divide the book, but the similarity as the reason to explain why people have always thought it's one author. It really shows that the similarities are very obvious. And it's very difficult to use this as a strong argument to divide the book. The point is that dividing the book of Isaiah based on source critical methods like linguistic usage, differences in words, differences in style, is very difficult to do. The differences are not so great. The similarities are very obvious. This is not a very strong argument. So, where does that leave us? It leaves us with only one Isaiah? Well, I think so. And we're going to, but we still have a couple things we need to deal with, but we're out of time for today. So tomorrow we will continue that and see where it leaves us. And then tomorrow as well, then we'll look at the second example. The second major case study we'll look at is the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels. And we'll see what these critical methodologies do with these books in terms of where these books came from. And that actually will be positive. There's actually something good there. So tomorrow won't be negative, promise. At least not all of it.